This is Whiskey and IR Theory, the podcast where we drink whiskey and talk about IR theory. My name is Daniel Nexon. I'm a professor in the Department of Government in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. My co-conspirator, Patrick Jackson, wasn't able to make it today. He said something about work, which struck me as odd, so I assume it's an administrative responsibility of some kind. Now, actually, I kind of lied at the outset. This is what we call a whiskey optional episode, which means that we have guests on to talk about something that's kind of related to IR theory. And because they're guests, we don't want to have to force them to drink. I mean, what if they don't drink? And certainly we don't want to force them to drink whiskey. If they have other libations of choice, they should be able to imbibe those. I've asked our guests to have a conversation centered around the question, what is the state of constructivist theory? I found their answers pretty interesting. I hope that you do as well. So let's get on with it. I'm going to start to my virtual right and work my way around the virtual room. So first up, we have Professor Brent Steele. He's in the Department of Political Science at the University of Utah, and he is currently the co-editor of an exciting initiative in open access publications by the International Studies Association, Global Studies Quarterly. Hey, Brent.
Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for having me here.
Next up, we have Michelle Yurkovich. She's an assistant professor at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. Welcome, Michelle.
Thanks for having me here, Dan.
Continuing on is David McCourt. He is an associate professor at UC Davis in the Department of Sociology and somebody who's written a fair amount recently on the state of constructivist theory and with some very strong opinions. So I'm hoping we'll get to hear from him and our other panelists will maybe push back a bit. Welcome, David.
Thanks so much, Dan. Thanks for having me. I hope so too.
Last but not least is Swati Srivastav. She is an assistant professor of political science at Purdue University. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dan. Happy to be here.
Before we can discuss what the state of constructivism is, we have to have some idea of what we mean by constructivism. And I know that not everybody has the same understanding. So let's start with you, Brent. What is constructivist theory?
How meanings are made and what happens when those meanings are disturbed and the international and global political outcomes that result from that and that shape that.
Michelle, is that how you explain the concept to your students?
Well, I'm going to defer to Swati on the myriad varieties of different constructivist thinking that exist. I think maybe because it's dinner time here in California, I would imagine talking to my students about how to set a table when you have a big group of people with very diverse dietary preferences and restrictions, and what would you actually serve? And at that level, I think the best I could come up with was it's an approach that says understanding the social exercise that is international politics is essential because in doing that, we understand how identities are constituted and how certain behaviors are enabled or constrained.
I mean, I would distinguish, for example, between a social constructionist claim and a capital C constructivist argument, with constructivism being something, a particular moment or movement in international relations theory, while a social constructionist approach being the broader thing. Some of you gave answers that I think reminded me very much of what we would talk about as a broad sense of social construction. Nobody really actually talked about constructivism per se, which is a nice segue into the basic question that we are meeting here to discuss, which is what is the state of capital C constructivist theory in international relations in 2021? Brent, why don't you start us off again?
So I have probably two or three ways to answer that. And hopefully I'm not stomping on anyone's thunder here. I know I'm going to be stomping on Dave's because I'm going to agree with one of the ways in which he characterizes it. But a lot of the constructivist projects that I was a part of and that I headed up probably about 5 or 6 years ago, that Dave was part of, for instance, looked at it generationally. And so the state of constructivism could be kind of characterized or at least narrated. And this isn't the only way you can do it generationally. So you think about the first generation Nick Onuf is called the dinosaurs of like him and Fritz Kraddickville and maybe Alexander Wendt. He could be a tweener sometimes, the second generation of the 1990s constructivists that we can talk about here in a little bit. The third generation that I put Dan and I in there, I kind of put Dave in there as well. Writing in the 2000s and the early part of the last decade. And then I think there's a fourth generation emerging with Dr. Yurkovich and Dr. Srivastav, especially with the work that they're doing and the ways in which they're specifying and further conceptualizing and or departing from some of the work that's been done before. So I can talk a little bit about that. My students definitely see this fourth generation emerging. I've seen it for a period of time at conferences over the years where they were all grad students and we were the ones that were kind of around talking about our work, and they were the grad students kind of critiquing it a little bit, but that's what happens with generations. So that'd be the first way that I'd characterize it. The second way very quickly would be in agreement with David that constructivism didn't leave or disappear. It just got repackaged to some degree. This is what he calls the new constructivism in his ISQ article from 2016 and his book that I'm going to be endorsing, by the way, David, I don't know if you know that, that's coming out very soon. And his point is that it was repackaged and repurposed and expressed through practice theory and relationalism. And those are the two shiny objects that he points to. I would agree, and I would actually say that there's some other manifestations of the new constructivism in other forms. Ontological security studies, which is a research community that I'm part of, is in part constituted by constructivism, but not solely. There's a lot of post-structuralists in there as well, but I think a lot of us that entered into it from the US Academy, we're coming into ontological security studies from a constructivist background. And then the third way that I'd characterize it, and I'll shut up here, I promise, is what I kind of teased out in this tactical constructivism volume that I edited a couple of years ago that Dave has a chapter in. I edited it with Harry Gould and Oliver Kessler. And that is comfortable versus uncomfortable constructivism. And this kind of gets people a little bit annoyed, but I pointed to that to talk about the folks like David. He's a very good example of an uncomfortable constructivist. And there may be others that would put it. And I don't mean that they're uncomfortable. They're not comfortable to be around or anything else, but that they are still concerned with constructivism state in the academy. Is it, you know, in the most popular journals? Is it being cited? Are there constructivists at some of the most powerful and elite institutions or not? And trying to get into those parts that are otherwise usually the realms of mainstream IR. And so those are, they're uncomfortable because they're trying to seek out a space and place, and they constantly are. This is why they're important for constructivism. And then there's the comfortable constructivists that are everywhere, but we don't think about them and we don't see them. And they're in teaching colleges, they're in administrative positions. They may not be publishing a lot, but they're constructivists as well. And they're actually in some ways liberated to publish anything that they want because research may not be the primary way in which they're being evaluated in terms of their work. And yet they're constructivists as well. Jamie Free, who's at Bridgewater College, for instance, is somebody that's revolutionized by building an infrastructure when it comes to pedagogy and international relations. He's a constructivist, but he's not publishing a lot on constructivism, but he could definitely have a lot to say regarding it. And so that comfortable camp is one that we often don't see, but they're everywhere. We just don't acknowledge, we just don't necessarily see them.
So we have comfortable constructivists and we have, I guess, uncomfortable constructivists, which I thought was going to be a distinction between people who did normal science and people who did critical work, but clearly isn't. So let's hear from some of the people who are in that fourth generation. Do you think of yourself as fourth generation constructivist?
I have never thought of myself as a fourth generation anything per se. When I look in the mirror, I don't say good morning, constructivist. But do I do constructivist work? Yeah. And am I most interested in and most challenged by constructivist scholarship and constructivist approaches? Yes. But I think it's telling because as I was listening to our responses here, I was realizing I don't recall the last time I asked myself that question. What is the state of constructivism in the field? And it isn't because I'm not very interested in concepts and you know, empirical phenomena that are often studied through constructivist approaches, but the state of the boundaries of the field, I guess, or the approach isn't something that I often spend a lot of time thinking about. But I would say, you know, if pushed, it is what constructivists make it to be, but it's also what it's allowed to be. And I think that the power dynamic there is really important. So as a junior faculty member, it is always apparent the boundaries of what you're able to do, what types of questions you're able to ask and publish are constrained by what the field permits you to do. And that, I think, is a real relevant concern for people who do constructivist work.
Swati, do you want to get in here?
Yeah, thanks. So I'll have two responses. One about myself as a fourth generation constructivist. And yeah, I call myself a constructivist, even though initially that title was given to me in my first week of a grad seminar where I didn't even know about constructivism. It was never assigned to me in undergrad. And I started talking at UChicago and they were like, you're a constructivist. I'm like, who's that? What's that? And then I went to the pub and figured out who Alex Wendt was. And that was 10 years ago. And then I think it actually became a really important part of my identity at Chicago to defend it, because actually it was not the most welcoming place, surprise, surprise, to be a constructivist. And I decided to claim the mainstream. You know, I actually probably still call myself a Wendtian constructivist. I'm one of those rare people that exist here. And I think it's really important for me to not self-marginalize and claim that I'm talking from the margins. I want a space for what I do in mainstream journals, mainstream presses, and to talk to mainstream scholars and claim comprehensibility, which they often deny to us. And so I think it was actually a really important part of my identity in grad school. And then later when I moved to Northwestern, you know, I didn't have to be as defensive anymore and, you know, found a cohort of great people who were thinking about the same things. And then going to ISA Northeast, meeting up with you all of that helped me flourish and I became less defensive. But the brand is still stuck from the early days. And I'm actually pretty proud of that. And then relatedly, the second point is on the state of the field. You know, we had this piece that asked in 1999, is anybody still a realist? And I think in 2021, we can ask, is anybody still not a constructivist, right? You know, John Mearsheimer published this piece 2 years ago in about realist international orders, and his realist orders is very constructivist-y, right? You think about norms, you think about identity. He's talking about all these things now and claims this is always part of realism, which is great. You know, some of us have been saying that forever, and now he's including that into his work. But I do think the difference is that we see, you know, this sort of shallow version of constructivism that's widely accepted. And I think there are only a few pockets where there's actually depth involved in dealing with social theory or dealing with what constructivism's promise used to be, which I know Dave has also talked about. So I think about it as a widely accepted social reality, but in a very shallow way. And that is something that I'm concerned about because we don't have as many people dealing with the consequences of that. But yes, definitely constructivist, very grateful to the third gen, especially that has paved the way. And I don't think anybody's not a constructivist anymore.
You know, it's almost like I'm hearing people say that constructivists won a series of victories in the 90s and 2000s, convincing a lot of people that quote unquote ideational factors or norms or identities might matter in international politics, but in a sense, lost the war as a result. Is that fair at all? I don't know. Dave?
I think it's fair. I think it's a good characterization. I think that if you look at what happened in the 90s, you see, particularly in the Journal International Organization, which at that time really was the sort of the hallmark of the top of the field, we could sort of question whether it still is, but maybe the field got too split up, if you like, fractured. But in the 1990s, there was a series of articles by people like Marty Finnemore, Catherine Sicking, Peggy Keck, Richard Price, Chris Roy Smith, and I'm sort of named them all because it was actually a fairly small number of people, Cecilia Lynch and Audie Klotz, that's about it. And they managed to publish in IO, managed to then turn that into a book with Cornell University Press. Again, I'm sort of naming these things because we tend to sort of dance around them, but they're actually really part of the game that we're striving towards. And so what they did was they managed to mainstream constructivism. But if you actually look at the number of articles in IO, APSR, World Politics over the 90s and early 2000s, it's actually a fairly small number. It's sort of like a 5-10% of articles that were like that. And then they didn't really need to publish in those journals anymore and didn't really need to try to advertise constructivism. And so I think that's right. They won a particular kind of battle. I wouldn't say it was the battle. I think they won a battle for a position. One could say they won the battle for the, what's the third big paradigm? So realism, liberalism, instead of Marxism or radicalism, it became constructivism. But I don't think that they won the battle. But you're absolutely right, Dan. I think that they did actually lose a war of a sort when they maybe let their guard down a little bit.
Well, it's kind of a problem if your great victory is to be included among the triumvirate of paradigms a couple of years before people don't want to talk about paradigms anymore.
Right. I mean, that is part of the story that we'll have to talk about. And Swati and Michelle both mentioned this. What happened to the paradigms? And was constructivism's trajectory just foreordained because there wasn't room for paradigms anymore?
Everybody's kind of making the argument that they have to kind of hide something about their claims or hide their constructivism a bit or adapt the kinds of arguments they want to make in order to succeed in publishing, in order to accumulate academic capital, you know, and rise in this business. Is that part of what's going on? Are people not just, is it people don't want to think in those terms or don't think in those terms? It's just that they're afraid to be out of the closet, as it were.
I'll jump in there on that point or that provocation, I think, because I don't think there's any, it just depends on who you ask. There's a couple ways to look at that. I think one is that you can actually look at constructivism, and this is both a virtue and a vice, as the way, at least for those of us that were trying to get jobs in the 2000s and 2010s in the US Academy, as a way to say that we weren't that out there. But, you know, it could be linked to whether, as Swati mentioned, the mainstream Wendtian constructivism, or it could be linked to the 1990s second gen constructivists who really did put their studies up vis-a-vis realism and liberalism and say this can explain something that those cannot. So really putting it within, you know, paradigmatic comparisons, even though paradigms are no longer fashionable. You could do that, and that created a space for you. But the other way to look at constructivism, which I do, because that can be very exclusionary, because then it's now constructivism or a certain version of it, a less scary version of it, is now accepted. But then that means that you can't flirt with or, you know, work with or, you know, entertain texts and resources and scholars who are outside of that. That can be very exclusionary. I use constructivism as a gateway drug because I could be introduced to constructivism. And for me, the bar was it was so low. I was told so much in graduate school that constructivists just didn't get jobs. Now, when that turned out to be not true, I was like, well, if they were wrong on constructivism, what else were they wrong on? Well, they were probably wrong on post-structuralism. They were definitely wrong on feminism. So I might as well just jump into all of those too. And then when you think about the international and globalized aspects of especially what's happening with the 21st Century International Relations Academy, and this is where conferences are so important, especially in person, and you get to meet people that are outside of the US Academy who maybe don't even call themselves constructivists, but definitely know what kind of language you're using, then it's like a whole nother world opens up to you. And so then it's a case where you actually don't have to be in the closet anymore. You can just, like, you know, do whatever. You can read whatever. You can invoke whomever. And because of that, then I think that really does enrich what you're doing, even if nobody else recognizes it. It gives you're talking about meaning making and constructive. I mean, that gives a meaning to what it is that you're doing. So there's different ways that can go. It can definitely be where you have to kind of tone it down a little bit, do the things you need to do, publish in the journals you need to publish. And to some degree, that never goes away. But there are other ways in which you can use it to enable an opening to other voices and perspectives that doesn't have to be exclusionary. So I've kind of gone a little bit away from what your provocation was, Dan, but I was thinking about that when you were asking it.
No, I mean, I think it's clear that any discussion about the state of constructivism, putting quotation marks, is going to involve questions of the academic politics, of the globalization of the academy, the kinds of structural changes that you're referring to. It's going to involve career considerations. It's going to involve ways in which the state of the world, exogenous shocks, as it were, affect what we do in international relations theory. I mean, it's very clear, for example, that constructivism gets a major boost from the end of the Cold War and the way that that for a time appears to throw everything out of whack and to discredit some approaches that were very dismissive of the kinds of factors that constructivists emphasize. But I do think it's interesting that we're sort of, in a sense, we're all kind of, and maybe this is because what David said, there's a kind of hesitancy to get into the weeds of, you know, just what exactly is this thing constructivism. I know that a lot of some of the people here, their response to that question is to think about different flavors of constructivism or different types of constructivism. Swati, you've called yourself a Wendtian constructivist. Some people here, like Michelle, I think of as like a foremost norms scholar. And then I think of norms as kind of being within a constructivist ambit. If we can't define constructivism other than as a particular kind of movement with certain people in it, is there a way we can talk about different flavors of constructivism that would be productive? Michelle, do you want to get in on this?
Actually, I got a. What's the? I don't know my sports metaphors. What is it? Is it bunting? Punting? When you when you knock the ball only a little ways, but you're yes, doing that
you
for Swati
bunt.
Because
this, Swati.
Yes,
okay.
Because this is definitely a Swati question.
Yeah, sure. So I have two ways to think about this. One is that going back to what Dan said earlier, we have social construction as the broader right social theory that informs not just IR, but sociology, anthropology, right? All these other disciplines that work with social construction. And then we have constructivism as a specific type of tradition that came in IR. And I think those have two different ways to have varieties. And so the piece that I have about varieties of social construction originally started as varieties of constructivism. And it made its way through the, you know, the rounds. And I decided ultimately I wasn't that excited about categorizing scholars and different isms. In fact, the whole piece was like, we shouldn't use words like thin and thick constructivist and critical and mainstream constructivist, because sometimes it implies like a difference in degree. Like I'm a better constructivist than you are because, right, I think about the social in this other way than you do. And I found that a little bit challenging to deal with because it's not that Wendt is a worse constructivist, you know, than Ono, for instance. They just have different wagers that they're making about social and constructivist. And so that was kind of motivated really by thinking about, okay, how do we, you know, think ontologically about what the social is and how do we construct things and maybe figure out, you know, mechanisms, even though that sounds kind of social science-y, but really the processes of social construction. And so that piece tried to kind of create space for young researchers to think about, well, how does this actually happen in four different ways? And then the second question about different constructivists, I think a lot of that branding is about the politics of discipline and where you find your community and what kind of reviewers you think you might draw. You know, we sometimes talk about constructivist and constructivist violence that happens in reviewing. And sometimes the toughest critiques you get are not from non-constructivists, it's from other constructivists. And so if you, and the same, we know this already as qualitative researchers, some of the reviewers we get from qualitative research have these, you know, demands that they make about stuff. So I think the ism war within constructivism and calling yourselves a particular kind of thin, thick, radical, mainstream, whatever, that does show up, you know, honestly, and it shows up in the top journals. So it's great. I think that actually recently my work has not gotten out to people that don't understand what constructivism is, but it is going, I think, to different types of constructivists. And actually appeasing them are perhaps harder than appeasing non-constructivists if they still exist. And so I don't know how to deal with that. I'm very happy dealing with varieties of social construction and talking to people about processes and things like that. I'm not as comfortable talking to different constructivists, especially if they have strong brand identities. And I think it does actually play out in the current publishing things and what ends up where and how people respond to critiques.
David, this seems like something you would probably want to get in on.
Yeah, gosh, there's so much to say. I agree with Swati in lots of ways. Throughout the history of constructivism from about 98 onwards, there's been numbers of different attempts to try to categorize this thing into certain different types. Swati mentioned critical versus mainstream or conventional. Sometimes causal versus constitutive has been thrown around a little bit as well. Maya Zephyrs wanted to do it in about 2005 by thinking about a sort of a Wendtian versus a Kritokvillian versus an Onuffian. So again, tie it to people rather than specific flavors. Now, the specific flavors tend to be about one's view towards scientific methods. So a critical of scientific method and pushing more towards post-structuralism, postmodernism, or a conventional and mainstream that really wants to stay within the normal science model of most of political science in the United States. So you could take up any of those in many ways. I don't tend to sort of label myself as one or the other. Another thing we should point out is we've been talking about it at a sort of a higher level of analysis, and I sort of pushed us there from the beginning. But in simple terms, three of the major things that constructivists tend to talk about are actually things in the world. They're sort of ontological, if you want to use that term. There's a strong focus on identity, culture, and norms. And I think those are the big three. Norms was obviously one of the big things that came in with the first generation of constructivists. Culture also came in at around the same time, sort of specific cultures of national security. Peter Katzenstein was big on that. And Ted Hopf also did some kind of stuff there. And identity, the idea that what states do in international politics, again, the sort of the biggest theme in IR and security studies particularly, is a function of who they are in the international system. I sort of tried to put a gloss on that and say, well, it's not just who they are, it's the role that they play on the global stage, but still within the same sort of framework. Those are three forms of constructivism. And it sort of depends on the kinds of questions, the kinds of objects you're wanting to analyze. Is it states? Is it non-governmental organizations? Michelle is perhaps sort of someone to bring in on that. But identity, culture, and norms, constructivisms is another way to split it up if we wanted to.
I'd also put language and discourse, something related to that. There's a distinct tradition that focuses on narratives, discourses, language, speech acts, following from Wittgenstein, but not just Wittgenstein, that you see in Onuf's work, Harry Gold's work, and others. So I'd throw that in there sometimes. And what we call that can be, you know, little bit slippery every once in a while. Sorry, Dave, you were going to jump in.
No, you're absolutely right, Brent. And what you've done is sort of called my bluff a little bit there, because the identity and culture norms distinction really works well within mainstream or conventional constructivism that wants to tell causal or quasi-causal stories against the mainstream. And so identity might be of a narrative form. Think Eric Ringmar's analysis of the 30 Years War from 1996. And one of these key works came in the mid-1990s. But Brent, when you bring in Wittgenstein, speech acts, language, you're pushing into the post-structuralist. If we Venn diagram, you know, Venn that paradigm kind of thing, and constructivism is somewhere in between post-structuralism and the scientific, more mainstream scientific approaches, it starts to drag you into that direction. Now, obviously, you know, I'm there and I'm with you. But that's why I sort of made that distinction.
Yeah, I would also just say that really after 2000, there is an emphasis, and even by self-identified constructivists, on rhetorical coercion, rhetorical commonplaces with Patrick Jackson's work and with Ronald Krebs, argument and change in world politics Nita Crawford's major statement, that that's definitely talking about dialogical processes. There's some that are inspired by Habermasian ideal speech, so Thomas Risse, for instance. And then those of us that spun off into ontological security studies, where we're talking a little bit about narrative, and then you have Janus Bialy Matern's work on representational force. So there is that, but again, that's also, I think, agreeing with what you're saying in terms of some of those perspectives. Karin Firka's work, for instance, drawing from Wittgenstein, they're starting to shade over into, you know, some of those liminal spaces between what we would call constructivism and post-structuralism. And then maybe that's maybe the dividing line between critical versus conventional constructivists as well. So sorry, I'll shut up again.
You and David and I could sit around and talk about these events kind of from the perspective of having been there, seeing these transformations happen, or at least remembering these transformations as happening. I don't know if I was aware of any of them at the time. So it's a kind of narrative, but it's very different, I think, to look back on these developments, which some of which may not seem important, some of which may seem very important, some of which may not even be part of the conversation. So I really want to get Michelle and Swati to come in and talk a little bit about how they see some of the kind of history that we're talking about, how they think about how their work is positioned in a longer intellectual stream.
Yeah, I think, so the process of writing the What Isn't a Norm piece that I have in International Studies Review was, I think, an illuminating moment for me in its many five rejections that it went through before it actually, you know, made it out into the world of how, and this is kind of similar to, along the lines of what Swati was saying, how different varieties of constructivist thought will engage or have difficulty engaging with each other. And oftentimes I think the strongest critique, come from if you label that piece more of a conventional constructivist work, I don't actually even see it as constructivist. It's about norms, which are not, you know, constructivists don't hold the monopoly on norms. But it is, it highlighted for me quite a few tensions over how we talk about and analyze constructive, quote unquote, constructivist work in the field. And partially, I guess my takeaway from that is it matters how many languages we speak. So a challenge, I think, for us as we review pieces and for junior scholars going through the review process is, what is the, you know, what is the comfort level of the average reviewer in speaking a language that is similar to the text that you are writing? And how do you evaluate in these different languages, different types of scholarship and merit? And I think that is within the constructivist family a challenge. So as Brent mentioned, for instance, the question of discourse. I cannot count how many times when I have presented on panels various pieces, usually a member of a more critical constructivist bent, either from a school in Australia or in Western Europe, will tell me that I need to take discourse more seriously. And if I don't do a discourse analysis, I'm not doing constructivist work. And so there are these interesting kind of fault lines that run through, that you kind of discover by falling into them, that run through this, you know, approach, which are, you know, important to understand. I don't know what to make of them, but I guess important to understand.
So one thing I want to go back to in terms of the battle and war metaphor is that some of our colleagues have battle scars, and they carry these battle scars with them when they review pieces. And it's perfectly fine to have that experience. Either they've had that experience, right, with other folks, or right, I mean, they've had a journey through this discipline, and this discipline is traumatizing for many people for many reasons. And so I don't begrudge anybody their battle scars, but I do think that it creates some tensions, precisely what Michelle was talking about, in how we talk to each other and if we're able to be comprehensible to each other. You know, before I was talking about being comprehensible to the Chicago people, right? Talking about realists and liberals and all those folks. But increasingly, as constructivism has become broader and bigger and more diverse and, like, you know, more global, actually, I do think the internal conversations are the ones that are perhaps more contentious now. And not that they shouldn't be, right? We should have pluralism, but I'm not always sure whether or not there's good faith engagement. So I think there's no obvious way for the fourth generation to deal with the battle scars faced in the previous generation. And maybe it's not even a generational thing. Like, I don't know who these people are, right? But I do think that's something I think about a lot, is what it has meant for these folks to go through this discipline and establish themselves or make a space for themselves as a constructivist enough to be called into reviewing, right, for these big journals. And then, you know, having that gatekeeping power and then what they do with that. And maybe I do the same thing in 10 years, right? Who knows? But it is something I've thought about a little bit, and it almost feels like they're subtweeting, right, comment that they've received before. And so I wasn't there. I don't know what happened in, you know, 1995 to you, but obviously that stuck with you in some way, or in 2005 or 2015. And so that is something that I've thought about a little bit as a more junior person, is just, I was not in the room when it happened. And yet some of the consequences are, I'm facing them, I guess.
I mean, I think there is a whole bunch of really important stuff in what you've just said. One of them is this idea of different kinds of experiences and different kinds of scarring in different generations or among different people who have been in the constructivist orbit. I don't have a better term for this. I know that when Patrick and Ron first were going around presenting their rhetorical coercion piece, a number of people who they saw as guiding lights for them, you know, people who helped orient them and the people who they looked up to, took them aside and said to them, you know, we don't kill our own. You shouldn't be criticizing us so much. Whether or not that's fair or unfair, what it sounds to me is like movement politics more than anything else. I'm just kind of curious. I have some experience of similar types of things. I know Brent, for example, that one of your mentors was very badly treated in some respects because of his constructivist leanings. I certainly know that people who I respect a lot got underplaced or had trouble placing groundbreaking work because of those kinds of things. And I know that for our generation, it's a bit different, in part because we're not at the vanguard, but in part because of the changing politics of publication. So I'm kind of curious how you all see this.
I mean, there's a lot there, and we can jump into it. I pivoting off both what you've asked and then what Swati just mentioned, which I think is very important, and Michelle as well, in terms of her experience. Just because people were treated a particular way doesn't mean that there's only one way then in which you pay that forward or pay that back. So there's a lot of different ways to do it. I think we could all, in different ways, with different levels of privilege, obviously, talk about different forms of treatment, different treatment experiences that we've had in the past. But then I think what's more important is a little bit how we pass that along. And so, I have a little vignette that involves Swati and the ISA Northeast that she mentioned, that Michelle has also attended and David's also attended over the years. In fact, David might've been at the round table where we did this. It was one of these constructivist round tables that we were doing that led to all of these publications and edited volumes and special issues and one symposium in PS, Politics and Political Science. And we were there, and I think some of us, it was mostly third gen constructivists. And I think we were kind of saying, well, we're not really, invoking constructivism anymore. We just talk about our experience stumbling into it and what we do with it, right? Getting back to Dave's provocation earlier. And Swati, I remember, raised her hand and told us from the audience exactly what you just mentioned a little bit earlier, how important it is to still identify with that. And there's another reason pragmatically in which you want to still identify with it. And that is that some people are identifying us anyway. Like I found out 2 weeks ago when I covered constructivism in my IR theory class, in my grad seminar, that's still the narrative here at the University of Utah. When other professors are asked about me, they'll say, oh yeah, Steele, he's a constructivist. I don't know necessarily where they're getting that. I'm not announcing that from the rooftop, so to speak. And so what do we do with that? Well, then I think that, you know, the biggest thing that we do is to translate to our students, first off, what that does in terms of how we engage the topics that we engage. So I can go in and I can point to a picture of Colin Kaepernick in my intro to international relations class and say, what is that? What does that mean when he's kneeling? And how is kneeling in that context different from genuflecting in a church, different from proposing to somebody for their hand in marriage? Why is one disrespectful and one not, and that, and then we're off, right? That's the first thing, is what do we do with it? And the second thing is creating a space for others to be able to do that as well, and for other voices. And that's, you know, what, getting back to what Swati's provocation at that roundtable, I think is very important, that there are other people that are out there that are looking at this. And as much as everyone talks about how they're done with the isms, if you title a panel or a roundtable constructivism, still to this day, everybody will bemoan, oh gosh, we're having these debates, we're talking about this and that again, and I'm so tired of it. And the panel will be packed. I mean, Pat, even after COVID, I guarantee it'll be packed, because people have a lot to say on this and it is important. So I don't think I really answered your question, Dan, but those are my thoughts in reaction to it.
One of my colleagues has a working paper, which is a network style analysis of citation patterns. But I know that their conclusion is that the so-called three paradigms still anchor all of IR, even if we pretend that they don't. And I know that I tried to teach Intro to IR last year without doing paradigms, and it was really hard to make anything make any sense. Dave, I know that in this context, I think some of your criticisms of people like me and others who have not been calling ourselves constructivists seem pretty relevant. So could you talk about why you think it's a problem that a lot of people who are doing work that would have once been easily recognized as constructivist, people who are still in that way of thinking about IR, don't call themselves constructivists or don't talk about themselves in terms of constructivism?
Yeah, thanks, Dan, for queuing that up. I think that folks like yourself in the 2009 Struggle for Power in Modern Europe, Early Modern Europe book, Patrick Jackson in Civilizing the Enemy book, some of Ron Krebs's work as well, maybe Janice Bialy-Matern as well. So work that was coming out there in the late 2000s, so 2008, 9, 10, 11, say. I read a lot of that and really enjoyed it and thought that it was extremely innovative. It was bringing in new ways of thinking about the social construction of international politics. And I was really struck by the fact that it wasn't doing it explicitly. And I started to think a little bit about maybe why that was and some of the effects of that. And I think part of the effect of that has been more recently, if you push on just a few more years into the 2011-12 and up to today, bringing in particularly practice theory. I'm thinking particularly Vincent Pouliot and Rebecca Adler-Nissen and Emmanuel Adler here with the practice turn. I think that what they were doing is doing constructivism, right? For me, if we think again of constructivism as not an is, but what it does, a process, then what we do practically is we read widely outside of our field, mostly in sociology, social theory, often some other cognate discipline, cultural anthropology perhaps, and bring in some of those insights into international relations. My book, I drew on George Herbert Mead. Brent, in his new book, Restraint in International Politics, is, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the psychoanalyst Jung. I hope I'm getting that right. And what we do is we bring those insights in. And I thought that's what you, Dan, and Patrick were doing so effectively. And so I was a little bit surprised and then started to say that this was really doing constructivism right. Now, I think that's a little bit harsh now of the second generation. And Brent and I have a disagreement about how the early empirical constructivists, if we can put them that way, Richard Price, Marty Finnemore, et cetera, whether the sins of omission and commission on their part. But I felt that new wave of work, and I still feel this about practice theory and relationalism, should be couched from within this broad space of constructivism, if we think of it as a space for having a different type of perspective in the IR theoretical landscape. And let me just briefly end by laying that out. Constructivists are not postmodernists or post-structuralists. They don't believe that there is a necessary backdrop to modern life, that modernity is building up to and pushing forwards. We're critical of that. We're also critical of realism. We're critical of the idea that international politics really is this struggle over power. We think that that is a social construction, as Alex went into what he says so nicely. We're obviously then critical of liberal internationalism, if you like, the positive flip side of postmodernism, that we accept that we're all moving towards a nice world in which happy norms orient our mutual interactions. Nick Onuf has this lovely phrase where he says, we are the only group of people in the discipline who foreground the process of construction without what is constructed being foreordained. He says it a lot nicer. But everyone else starts off with things already made. We don't.
So what do you all think of that?
I mean, I can back up the claim a little bit more, if you like, about practice theory and relationalism. If you actually look again at Alex Wendt, for example, he says really strongly in the article, I think, 1992 IO piece, about states produce anarchy through practice. He mentions the word practice multiple times. They don't create identities in games, sort of a game theoretic approach, ex ante. They do it through practice. This was absolutely all the way through Nick Onuf, Friedrich Krattockville, and Alex Wendt, if you just care to bother to look. Anthony Giddens was in that as a sort of intellectual inspiration. So was early Bourdieu. All of the stuff that is sort of miraculously being rediscovered in recent times. To me, that's what constructivism is and does. We go out and we bring in new ideas. But if we'd actually just read carefully the early stuff, we wouldn't have had to do the more recent practice relational stuff.
But it does seem like there's a tension in what you're saying, because part of, I guess the key word is empirical constructivists. Because what you're saying is that in many of the important theorists, Krattockville, Wendt, et cetera, you say that all of these elements are there, but then I think you are specific that there's something going wrong with empirical constructivism. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that was the price that the empirical constructivists paid to get published in International Organization. They said, look, there's something about, as you say, post-Cold War international politics, banning of landmines, the nuclear weapons taboo, the chemical weapons taboo, something about those self-restraint of states that can't be explained by mutual cost-benefit analysis rationality or a balance of power politics. We need to bring in something social. We need to bring in notions of norms, culture, identity, either at the international level. So think of someone like Milada Bukovansky in international political culture, or we do it at the national level. Think about someone like Peter Katzenstein, or even at the institutional or organizational level. Think of someone like Lynn Eden's fantastic work on domestic organizations that look at the use of force and their internal cultures and how they explain the behavior of those organizations. So if we can't explain state behavior through rational cost-benefit maximization or simple pursuit of power in an anarchical international system, we have to go to something like norms and culture. But that was brought in a very thin way, a particular way that really sort of ignored practice, it ignored struggle, it ignored many of the professions under which experts are actually struggling over, say banning something like landmines. So it was a very mainstreaming way of thinking about what constructivism could be. Now we would differ, and Brent might come back to me on this one, about whether that was a bad thing or a good thing. I think that it was very good because it brought in and created this space of constructivism, but it atrophied very quickly. Because if you say that state interests can't just be defined by rational cost-benefit maximization or the pursuit of power, then making that claim kind of gets boring after a few years, right? That states do things not just because of power, but because of norms. Well, only a certain number of people can make that claim before a journal says, well, we know this. What else do you have to offer? And so 20 years later, Vincent Pouliot can come in and say, well, it's not just the logic of appropriateness, it's also the logic of practice. And again, that's a nice novel claim, but it wouldn't have been a novel claim if we'd have all read carefully a little bit more the early theorists. Now, again, don't want to be on record of criticizing Vincent's fantastic work, but it is to highlight the ways in which the discipline disciplines us.
Dan, if I could jump in there real quick, and I'd really be interested to hear Michelle and Swati's take on this. But I think I think there's two points. One is the context in which a lot of these expressions of constructivism are being developed. The 1990s were also a hopeful period of time for at least the West or the Northern West in the world. And so sometimes that empirical constructivism that Dave is talking about gets linked to a progressive type of politics. And so for me, I'm not disagreeing at all with Dave about whether the 1990s constructivism was good for the field. I think it was really good. And I wouldn't have had a job if that hadn't come along. What I don't think it was good for was how constructivism was therefore characterized thereafter as only being that generation. What happened before with the more philosophical constructivists, the more theoretical ones of Onuf and Kroetkeville and Wendt, and then what happened after. And then, so this is where I would disagree with Dave. I think in the 2000s and the 2010s, when the global political situation seems to me to be going to shit. Edit that out, Dan, if I'm not allowed to go PG on here, but
it, we're explicit, we have the E.
Okay. That changes. And so like that's the era that we're coming up in. And so this is why Lyra and De Cavaro call the third generation the Baghdad generation. Kroetkeville calls the third generation the farcical generation. Like it's just like there is no God, so let's just not even take any of this seriously. But if we are going to take it seriously, let's mix and match. That's a farcical mode that he's talking about in his contribution to the special issue of European Review of International Studies that we published a few years ago. That generation is trying to, at the very least, not necessarily write against the second generation, but to carve out another space and say, this isn't a progressive politics. This is a very dour understanding of the world, and it's constructivist language and approaches and devices in terms of meaning making that are necessary to understand power politics, to understand force, to understand violence. A politics of identity that is there isn't always going to move everything in a particularly positive direction. Now, probably the empirical constructivists of the 1990s would also point out where they're pointing that it is an inevitable progressive sort of logic to their work either, but it's definitely not there in the 2000s and 2010s. And I think that there was probably a hyper reaction by some of us that were in that political era in the 2000s and 2010s. It was really trying to show that the reason why constructivism hit that tuning fork within us, as Jamie Free has called it, is precisely because we could see constructivist language, reference devices, or whatever ways of approaching meaning making all around, and being able to explain some of the really bad stuff that happens in global politics. And so that's what we were trying to push back on. And you see it in textbooks, you see it in the ways in which constructivism is characterized as basically being just a little more theoretical version of liberalism. And we were pushing back on all that. So it was a little bit less of a direct sort of writing against that second generation. Now, my students are already noticing a distinction between our generation and then this emerging fourth generation in the works that are out there. And I can talk about that later as well, but I don't want to talk about that because I'm not part of the fourth generation. And that's not up to me to sort of narrate. So I just wanted to throw that out there a little bit.
I'd really like Michelle to come in on some of these issues if you've got some stuff you want to say. I think you do.
Well, I think one thing that I think about in listening to this is that I wonder, and this may be abstracting out a bit too much, but if the concern is that there is a poverty in our philosophical readings and our theorizing, I do wonder to what extent that's a unique problem for the constructivists. I mean, I tend to think that this is a critique you could lay on the field generally. And in many ways, it seems like we actually have kind of cut ourselves off at two ends of the stick here. So we both as a field don't want to do too abstract theorizing or too philosophical theorizing, but we also don't want to do super descriptive work or descriptive only or mere descriptive work. And so we've kind of taken this like range of what can be, you know, the universe of thought and really clipped it into this very rather narrow middle band of what we're willing to engage with, which is middle range theory and descriptive work, but only the absolute bare minimum that you need in order to make a causal claim. And I think that itself is problematic, and that extends beyond this debate over constructivism.
Swati?
You know, if you cook something, sometimes the order in which you put in the spices changes a dish, right? You can, and sometimes recipes don't specify. So like if you make Indian food, there are like seven different things going on, and actually the cumin comes first and, you know, the cardamom comes second and so on. And that actually, and you have to bloom a little bit, and then eventually you get the flavor. And I think reading is a similar way. So what you read and how you read and what order actually really matters for intellectual flourishing and blooming. So, you know, today I'm going back and reading Waltz and Wendt for my grad seminar, and I'm getting more out of it than I did 10 years ago because I've read things in those 10 years that primed me to read them differently. Right. So, you know, in the in-between time, I've read John Dewey and William James, and now I care about pragmatism. And now I read practice theory differently. Right. And I read Wendt differently, and his version of practice. I think I have it. I'm primed now to actually look for that stuff, whereas I probably wasn't 10 years ago. And so I think one of the contributions of continual, you know, of Puglio and Adler and other works, even though you could say certainly what's really new here, and I agree with that, but I think they put it, you know, they put it back on the table, and they're like, all right, here's a key ingredient, and let's put it back in the recipe. And so we can go back and reread those works. I mean, how many times have we read The Prince or Leviathan, and you always find new stuff, right? Based on where you are and your period of life and what you find. And so I think that some of the most productive IR theory is that way. And, you know, I'll put Waltz there because I've been reading him again and again recently, and that piece about why Waltz is not a neorealist, right? And why we should care. And it makes you think a little bit differently about what he said and how the discipline could have been totally different if we understood a little bit more about his social aspects. Perhaps wouldn't have been a full constructivist, but right, he was getting there. He had ideas in there that you now read differently than you did as a first year grad student who had no idea all this stuff was in there. So I agree with Dave about it, but I do think the priming and the flourishing is part of your intellectual journey. And I think it just tells us we should be assigning more social theory, right? And maybe we'll pivot to the teaching stuff. Because I do think one of the biggest questions that I have today is that constructivism is hard to teach, both at the undergrad and the grad levels. And I think part of it is because you have to generate so much social theory and understanding about structure and agency for people to grapple with it. And it's not as easy as guns and power, right? And the stopping power of water or whatever, right? So. But I think ultimately, because it's hard, it's more rewarding, and it pays you off over a longer period of your life. You can reread these pieces and still get something out of it on your 50th time, because it changes how you understand what they think the social is.
Well, it's certainly the case that there's almost nothing which is really new. We're just talking about various ways of remixing things. And I really wish we would stop putting so much emphasis on novelty as a criteria for publishing something in, you know, a elite journal, which turns out to be all the journals. The thing about the difficulty of teaching, I'm not sure it's constructivism, but the difficulty of reproducing the route to constructivism, or being able to be fluent in constructivism, as it were. That's something that's been weighing on me a lot lately. And I think that one of the things that might be underappreciated about the opening in the 90s of social theory is that it allowed people to specialize in social theory and in the consumption and the production of social theory within IR in the way that we might specialize on some on anything else, like on a topic, on a method or what have you. And I'm not sure how anybody does that under current constraints. Like, I'm not sure how anybody decides that they're gonna really go out there. I know people do it. I know there are young scholars who are very fluent in a wide variety of social theory, not just stuff written in the last 10 years or not just the classic sociology, but inclusive of the things that we were reading in the 90s and taking inspiration from. But I think it must be so hard. There's just so much stuff that's accumulated now. The second thing that just, it's very obvious. If Bren is right, then we really are talking about constructivism as mirroring the zeitgeist, right, of the period and really being impossible to decouple from the state of international politics, or at least the state of international politics as seen from the global north. But what about this issue about, you know, the amount of work that it takes to engage some of this, some constructivist theory and some post-constructivist or fourth generation or third generation constructivism, or whatever you want to call it?
I think building off of what Dan said and Swati's interest too in challenge and how you teach constructivism, and you start with this as a genealogical exercise, or how do you introduce these types of concepts to students? I guess I found that the core insight of constructivism that is, I think, most compelling or interesting to students is imagining that the world didn't need to turn out the way it did. And so I often start discussions on constructivism with a thought experiment. I am interested in hunger, so I blend two interests in one. And I'll say to students, you know, imagine you have a seven-year-old child in the US somewhere, and place that seven-year-old child anywhere you want. And imagine that there is no free education available to that seven-year-old child. There's no public school or charter school where they can use vouchers. There's no school anywhere near them. They have no access to education, and their parents can't afford to send them to a private school. So who's to blame for that child's lack of education? And people uniformly say, the state. Government's supposed to provide, you know, there's got to be some sort of a public option for that kid to go to school. And I'll say, okay, well, let's imagine that same seven-year-old child goes home at night and doesn't have dinner. So who's to blame for the fact that that seven-year-old child doesn't have access to dinner? And then you have some people who will say, well, his parents, you know, should have worked harder, or isn't there a soup kitchen? I don't know, the Catholic church down the street, or maybe there's a food bank. But the diversity of answers leads to, I think, a usually useful conversation about how do we come to a place in society where we can agree, have this shared agreement that a state is obliged to ensure education for the seven-year-old child, but not food. How do we come to understand that? And usually backing in from kind of thought experiments and examples like that is the way that I start my constructivism lectures.
Well, yeah, I think that's a great way to teach it, Michelle. And the other way that you could do it is, and this is where I sort of make my plug for my particular vision of constructivism, which is essentially historical. As in, you could ask that question, well, what do you think, who should have provided food for that young person in 2021? What about 1845? What about 1638 in different places at different times? And I think this speaks to the issue of the difficulty that Dan's talking about, that Swati's talking about, because I think to be a constructivist, you have to be a little bit of an amateur historian. You have to be a political theorist, a social theorist, philosopher. And you've also got to do your day job of international politics of whatever stripe. And so I do think that social constructivism is probably the most difficult of the paradigms or the paradigmatic spaces to enter, because you have to do all of these things. Just pushing one more point is, recently I've been trying to spend my free time, of which there's about 13 minutes a day, reading Peter Sloterdijk, because I like to try to keep up with social theory and philosophy. Like, I think that that's part of my job. I think I should be fluent in what's going on. And thankfully, Sloterdijk is tough, but absolutely fascinating stuff. But it is this side job that I have to have, and I simply don't have time to do it. I just have a stack of amazing books to try to get through. And when you're reading them like that, you don't retain as much as you'd like to. But I think that's why constructivism is the hardest. And I think that's why when people are good at it, present company included, that we're doing some of the best work.
Brent, you had wanted to get in?
Yeah, no, I think this is a great point. And I thought a lot about this, about how we translate it to teaching constructivism, and then also how constructivism and being either trained a constructivist or within constructivism or constructivists ourselves shapes our teaching. Because I would actually venture a guess, the more important point is the latter one, which is, you know, how has being a constructivist or familiar with constructivism, if we don't want to identify that way, impacted the way in which you teach? My guess is that you're all great teachers. I mean, that's just my guess. And that's arrogant to say, but why? You know, what is it that would predispose us to being good? One is the work that goes into it. And I don't actually always consider it work, but you do have to be steeped in social theory. More than likely, if you're in a U.S. political science department, a lot of the folks that you have conversations with or can have conversation with, holding personality at the level of a constant, are going to be political theorists, because you can read the philosophical abstract theory and get into those kinds of meta debates. If not very easily, you can hold your own within that. So there is a lot of work that's there. But why is it that we maybe can feel comfortable teaching generally, and then how do we get to the issue of teaching constructivism? I think teaching generally is that we understand that there are multiple meanings for any topic that we have. And so as a result, we can be very, I think, you know, I know this is a word that's invoked all the time, but we can be inclusive. We can point to people and say, there's not just one way in which we look at this. And in fact, the ways in which we look at that say something not only about it, but about us. That's constructivism, right? And so, you know, having that space and that challenge of finding it not just subjective understandings, but can we get to a point of an intersubjective agreement? That's great, right? And how do we teach constructivism? I think it's an art, not a science. I think it takes a constant, you know, series of attempts and refinements over the years. But for me, what I've tried to do is to just think about the ways in which I know, being steeped in constructivism, it's impacted the way in which I just view everyday things. So, you know, I tell students in terms of the importance of language and creating meanings and changing social reality, that at least back in the day, when somebody asked you if you were dating somebody, even dating right there changed the social reality of it. No, we're just talking. No, we're just seeing one another. No, well, okay, now we're dating. Oh yeah, now we're exclusive. Now we're engaged. Now we're married. I mean, every single one of those terms changes the social reality of how you view that relationship, how somebody else views that relationship, and what the relationship actually is for other people. And so giving that example, sometimes I talk about agents and structures, and the interplay between agents and structures, and explaining how the different interplays between agents and structures can actually develop, that structures aren't independent from agents and agents aren't independent from structures. And that has an important political point. When we talk about structural forms of violence and oppression that impact us and we can't really impact them, but sometimes those structures have agency within them. That's why Nick Onuf in 1988 said we should stop talking about structures and constructivism and talk about social arrangements, because there's some agency there in that structure. And so just getting into that kind of stuff and just trying, and like I mentioned with, you know, just putting up a picture and saying, what is that? That's an ontological question, right? And then just having different people describe it with their words, and how they describe it changes the meanings that we have of it. That can be just kind of, I think, a good entry point to do that. Now, there's a risk in doing any of that. It can really fall apart. And I know that, you know, I'm a full professor with tenure, so I can do things like that. And there's a point of privilege there. But doing things like that, I think, are ways in which you can get to constructivism. And then, like, there's never been a better time to talk about how there are contested meanings right now in global politics. We absolutely need to talk about how meanings are contested and how they are constructed, and so on and so forth, sometimes at the expense of survival and well-being. David, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I just really wanted to point out, you said there that Nick Onuf had focused on and drawn our attention to social arrangements, right? So think of assemblage theory right now, and Bruno Latour and actor network theory that's been brought back in as the bright new shiny object. Nick was already there. Not to say that assemblage stuff isn't good, but it's not really the new thing.
So I just wanted to add one point about teaching. And for me, what's I think difficult about it is that it's so intuitive, the idea of social construction, that, right? That's why people had to label me one, because I didn't know I was one until people call me that. I'm like, oh yeah, I believe this. But at the same time, as Dan said, you still have to be well-versed in how other people have thought about this over time and history, and that there are all these different ways and they complicate each other. You know, so sidebar, I'm submitting my final book manuscript tomorrow. So yay, it's exciting, I know.
Congratulations.
Not gonna drink too much whiskey, but, or maybe it'll help, I don't know, who knows. And you know, it took 7 years to get through, right, creating what I think is a fresh constructivist approach to sovereignty, because so many people have written about that, and even just understanding that, right, and giving intellectual debts, and then carving a fresh space and using social theory, you know. And I tell people I have 3 theory chapters, and they're like, what? And you're like, yeah, I know. It's just, there's a lot of theory to get through, because a lot has been written. And part of it, I think, is that people are not as encouraged to read widely as they used to be, right? So in grad school, the time to degree is getting shorter, and people are assigning things that they're working on right now. And I guess I was a little bit lucky that at both Chicago and Northwestern, I was forced to read widely, and I still do. And as Dave said, that is, I think, a practice of constructivists, is that we read in other fields, we borrow, we try to translate it back, and it takes effort to understand. I mean, that all those like Latourian diagrams, man, those are hard. Like, what is he talking about? And yet, right, you struggle through it, and that's part of the journey. And then I have, like, I don't know, 20 diagrams in this book. So there's, you know, you kind of use that. And so I think that's why I think it's a little bit difficult, because to me, it's so intuitive, and explaining it to students who they've been maybe perceived or filtered that it's going to be really hard to understand this thing. And it's really not, right? It's actually, they experience it every day. And I know Michelle has that experience at a Cal State University, and that was my first job before I came to Purdue. And actually teaching those students about structure was really easy, because they were living structure. They knew what those constraints are. And, you know, we read Marx, they're like, yeah, we get Marx, we get racism. And it's a little bit harder to do it out here. And so you kind of have to work a little bit more to get them to understand that. But, you know, I always liked to have sort of the David Foster Wallace fish and water story, right? The two fish are going in water, and an older fish comes by and says, hey, how's the water? He goes along, and then the two fish say, what the hell is water, right? And so if you have to constantly remind them, this is water, it takes effort. And perhaps, right, it's by doing image work on Kaepernick, or it's by asking them, okay, how do we construct the Cuban Missile Crisis as a crisis, right, and assigning work about that, or Mitzen's ontological security always plays really well with students. But it takes a lot of effort to curate, I think, that kind of experience for students, to make what you think is super familiar and intuitive, right, translate that so that they actually understand it, and not just come away with, it's just norms, it's just morals. Because that's something, even though norms is part of constructivism, and so is it cultural identity, as Dave said, I don't think it's all that. And so for me, I guess the biggest takeaway is I really want them to understand structure and agency and identity. And if they get those three concepts in their social life, I feel a little bit, okay, my job is done. But it is a struggle, and I appreciate, you know, so I think Brent wrote a chapter in the Jamie edited volume about journeys in world politics. And actually that was really useful for me to read about other people's journeys and trials and errors. And actually talking more about pedagogy generally is, I think, a really welcome development that IR has been doing recently.
I want to make sure that we talk a bit about what's going on right now amongst people who we could call constructivists, or maybe even do call themselves constructivists or see themselves that way. So I'm an old fogey here. My memory from what we got at ISQ and what's sort of crossed my desk or what people send to me since I left the editorship there is that part of what we're seeing is the injection of some different theoretical domains. So science and technology studies in general, actor network theory in particular. To me, that's a very evolutionary position. If you think about practice theory, if you think about relational accounts, if you think about the story that I think David tells really well in his book, which I will put a plug in for here. When I look at new work, which is plausibly constructivist, some of the hallmarks of that new work are interesting synthesis of different kinds of theoretical traditions into novel but familiar packages. I see some of the old kind of turn stuff. I am holier than you are on this issue about the practiceness of the practicality of the practice, but not as much as you might be afraid of. And then I see some really attempts to systematically interrogate concepts that maybe are getting taken for granted as they've become decoupled from their social theoretic moorings. And that's why I invoked your work on norms. So that's what I see when I look at constructivism, is a lot of sampling to produce new and interesting stuff. But I don't see clearly any major movement that's sweeping the field that is really different than that that tripartite approach that David talks about, you know, that is practice, relational, and T. But I could be wrong. I don't know. I'm not hip. I don't follow things so closely. And I was wondering how you see that, either how you experience that if you are somebody who is working on new, or what you actually see in the world.
I think that's a really good insight, Dan. I think that that's really where we are. I differ a little bit from Brent on the question of the generations and where we are right now. I think we're still in the midst of the third generation, what Brent would call, I think, the fourth generation. We can debate this. He's shaking his head vigorously. Because I speak as someone who's still working with broadly practice relational stuff, using thinking a lot with Bourdieu on the sociology of knowledge and expertise, which I think is sort of one of the biggest trends, because it's easy to use practice theory, relationalism, ANT. It really all is a sort of a reflexive looking at the producers of certain types of knowledge systems. So I think that a lot of people are still working that out. If you think of Emmanuel Adler and Vincent Pouliot's work from 2011 as sort of a forerunner of this third or fourth, in Brent's terms, generation, then there's still a lot of us that are trying to work it out. It takes time, right? You know, like I'm writing a couple of books, and they're going to take a little bit more time to come out. So I think what we're going to see over the next 4 or 5 years is sort of this is still that kind of working out, nitpicking some of it, you know, what is the practice turn really all about? And again, if you actually go back and look at what was going on around 2001, 2003, think of Ted Hobbs' book, Social Construction of International Politics. It's a little bit like that, right? Vis-a-vis what was going on in 95, 96. There was all sorts of things thrown in there, social cognitive understanding of identities and all that stuff. I think we might see a little bit of a smorgasbord type theoretical landscape for the next few years. And then what I would predict would be some new constructivism that looks very similar to practice theory and relationalism, but we're still a little ways off us all getting bored of practice theory, particularly. Once we're bored of it, someone's going to make a career from bringing it back in. Very pessimistic and cynical, I know.
Yeah, I agree with both what Dan and David have said here. I think I guess what I think that means is that there's still an awful lot, as we look out into the world, even just the empirical world, that is difficult to explain, even with the very robust toolkit that we have in the constructivist approach. And I think that's exciting. It means that there is still a lot of work to be done. The book that I had that just came out last year with Cornell on anti-hunger advocacy is a constructivist analysis, but it is primarily interested in when we observe this. Oh, thanks, Swati, for showcasing it. When we observe this space where there isn't a norm, I would argue, around the who ought to do what to ensure that people have access to the food that they need. How do we make sense of that space? And how do we think and use the concepts that we have and the mechanisms that we have to kind of interrogate it? And so I guess on that end, I would end on an optimistic note, which is there is a vast and complex world out there. And for my students, I end by saying the world is a huge tent, and it should be, and there's a lot that we still don't understand. There's our tools show their strain and show their weakness when we hold them up to the world that we live in now. And so that's going to ensure we have a job, I guess, in the years to come.
Swati?
So I think there's like a missing group here we haven't fully talked about, which is the Europeans, or as I lovingly call them, the Euros. And so a big part of my intellectual journey has been to go over across the pond, right? As we all do, and we go to the conferences there because sometimes, you know, a lot of interesting work in critical constructivism is happening there. And there's, when I read stuff coming out of Europe on constructivist theory, which more often than not doesn't even call themselves constructivism, right? But they're not just working on new materialism, it's like aesthetic theory, right? It's all this other stuff. They did Actor Network 10 years ago and we're still catching up. And so it's actually a very different environment. And sometimes you collaborate with people from across and again, there is a sense of, well, I'm not there yet. I haven't gotten into my aesthetic theory yet. I'm still reading my Latour, or I'm still reading whatever. And in American IR, I think it is a little bit different because, you know, either we have the pressures of publications or the time to degree or just who's around to mentor students and what they can read. Like there's a little bit, right? Everybody's noticed this before about narrowing. And so I find that sometimes talking to and reading the European social theory helps me, but sometimes, you know, I think that it's too insular. I don't understand a lot of what they're talking about because I just haven't been, either I don't have time to catch up with it, or I don't have the incentives to catch up with it. And so I always find that really interesting because I think when they see what I'm doing, I'm like, well, this is something that you talked about years ago. You were so behind, you know, catch up, little American. And then I go over there, I'm like, what are you talking about? Anger is not a method, which at some point somebody told me during a methods workshop. And I'm like, no, anger is not a method. We have these other methods, other methods. So I always find, you know, I tell my grad students that I'm actually a very foundational traditionalist at heart, and it comes out when I go to Europe and I talk to people on these panels, because even though they're doing really great cutting edge theory stuff, they're talking about things that my mind cannot even wrap myself around because I'm still trying to talk to American IR folks, right? And so I think the future of theory is going to be a little bit fragmented because we have these separate markets and separate incentives about who we're talking to, who the audience is. And, you know, a lot of the people here certainly resonate in Europe, right? You're all probably treated like rock stars when you go there. Everybody's like, hey. And yes, you are. It's fine. But there's still, right, like we still have this American audience. And at least, you know, like I said in the beginning of the podcast, I'm invested in making sure that mainstream American IR becomes pluralist and interesting and diverse. And sometimes it actually does come at the expense of cutting edge social theory. And maybe that's what happened in the 90s, and maybe it's going to happen again. But so I agree that there's a lot of mismatch happening and people are doing a lot of interesting stuff. I'm just not convinced that it's going to happen here, or it'll be 20 years later. And then maybe in 2050, we're going to talk about stuff that the Europeans are talking about. And so sure, in the major journals, right, they'll be represented and they'll push us forward. And I'm not saying all American social theorists are this way and have those incentives. But I think there's a little bit of a difference between two and what the different incentives are for junior scholars and what kind of training they're able to receive and how much they're reading and what kind of mentorship they get. Because I still think in the US, it's a little bit difficult to go to a top program and be taught aesthetic theory.
I want to hear from Brent, but I want to raise two things because we're running out of time and make sure, because I want to put them on the table and make sure that maybe people get a chance to think about them. The first is, I'm actually extremely interested by some of what you said, Swati, because when I think about the work I was talking about, about 90% of it is being done in Europe, right, or being done overseas. So I don't actually see that much of the kinds of constructivism we're talking about being produced at research universities in the United States. So that's interesting. Like it's interesting to me. The second thing is that
uncomfortable constructivism. You're very uncomfortable.
Very uncomfortable. I look uncomfortable, don't I? The second thing is that invoking going across the pond, invoking a world outside the US, of course, runs us into the fact that IR is clearly globalizing. Right? We see this at our conferences. We see this at journals. It's an issue that editors struggle with. Everywhere we go, there is a more diverse, although in some ways that's a low bar, but nonetheless a more diverse and certainly more nationally diverse field. We are also talking about part of the rise of and the development of some of the countries that did not have per capita incomes that were significantly middle class is massive expansion of education and educational institutions and production of scholars trained sometimes in the United States, but also trained in different traditions. We're going to do something, I hope, eventually on the state of Chinese IR. And that's, I think, a good example of something that's coming across the horizon. So there's that question of how that development interfaces with our discussion. So I know that's a lot. I want to make sure that everybody, that Brent has a chance to get in on some of the questions that we've already been talking about. Maybe you can transition to this, but I'd like to hear from everybody about this issue of the globalization of IR and what it means for Americans, Anglophone scholars doing something that we might call constructivism.
Well, I mean, the last point that you just mentioned, Dan, kind of for me resolves a little bit of the issues and quandaries that Swati was bringing up that I think a lot of us connect with. I mean, I was doing the same thing in 2005, 2006. I went to my first BISA, for instance, in 2006, and it was like a whole, I've written about this, it was like a whole other world opened up for me. And yet we have an infrastructure now, and we really have for the last decade that you've been part of, Swati, that Michelle has, that Dave has, that Dan and Patrick Jackson and some of the other sort of, you know, big pioneers of the ISA Northeast provided us in the ISA Northeast, both with the Interpretive Methodologies Workshop, the Pedagogy Workshop, and then just ISA Northeast as well. Patrick Jackson calls it the little space of Europe in the United States Academy. And he doesn't mean that just tongue in cheek. I mean, so I think that we actually have the possibility now with the globalized features of international relations to have our cake and eat it too, to have these outlets. We also have more journals as part of that infrastructure. We also, I think, have had some strides in terms of setting the stage for what I think is some of the best work that's being done nowadays by the not emerging, but the emerged generation. I would distinguish it from my generation. So I would push back a little bit with David, which I have done before, and I'll do again hereafter, probably over a beer and not whiskey. But that we have had some developments. I think Patrick Jackson's Conduct of Inquiry book, where he is distinguishing monism and dualism. And you see some of the similar distinctions regarding constructivism and Karaska and Craddockville's work regarding consistent versus inconsistent constructivism. I think some of those developments have pushed constructivism forward and then allowed for a good launching pad for some of the great work that's out there. Now, when it comes to mixing and matching, that's actually Craddockville's definition of farce. He actually calls farcical or farce when he titled the farcical generation of the third generation. I quote, a certain mix of different and contradictory elements within a single genre. So this is something that has been going on for a while. And yet I think it's being not just introduced, but perfected by a lot of the works that are going on nowadays. But as a result, what has been part and parcel along with constructivism, if not necessarily all within it, we got the emotions, work on emotions and affect and body. And aesthetics, I mean, Swati mentioned it earlier. A lot of us that are interested in aesthetics are also, you know, coming from a constructivist angle. There's a lot of work on race. Race is something that maybe was a little bit neglected or just not picked up enough in constructivism, but it's front and center there. Alex Barger's recent book, it's just fantastic, is putting that front and center, and he's not the only one. And so I actually think that there's a lot of great work that's out there. It's almost too good. And what I mean by that, and this is where I'll shut up, is that we just have so much good work that's out there. And late modernity as a backdrop, I don't know if that makes me a post-structuralist or not, but it's so fast. Everything is so fast right now, just generally in terms of social life, that it's hard to keep up with anything. We're all a lot busier. The superstructure of the academy has led us away from research, away to some degree from teaching, away from the hard work of doing the reading of social theory, and instead filling out forms and doing lots of other things that we spend our time on, that we can't keep up with all of it. And so that's the challenge. And so I think there's great work out there. It's just a real challenge to be able to keep up with it. And that to me is why, in terms of social life and the sociality of constructivism or international relations as an academy, we absolutely need these conferences, because that's where we can get up to speed. And yeah, we catch up with friends, and there's a social sort of friendly aspect to that as well. But that's where we also discover these things that have eluded us in our everyday patterns and routines.
Any other final thoughts?
Just a really quick one, Dan, on the European element of the story. Swati's absolutely right that what happened in the 1990s was really the story of the globalization of international relations. It goes way back. It's not just recent years. European Journal of International Relations is a big part of this story, founded in 1995. Kratochvil's its founding editor. And if you actually look at where a lot of this were, well, Kratochvil was one of the first editors. A lot of the...
It was Walter Karlsnes was the...
Right. Was Fritz next. Yeah. It was in there. And then a lot of the good work comes about out in those journals. And then if you actually look at the first generation of empirical constructivists in the US, most of them left. Most of them left to Europe. And then the other part of this story is Australia and the expansion of the Australian Academy. Just look at Australian IR. It's a really big part of this story. So as I've written sort of elsewhere, constructivism is a label that really only makes sense in America, but it's got this hub in Europe. I think I only got a job because I'd published in Review of International Studies and Millennium, and those are European journals, even though constructivism isn't really a thing over there. The other thing I just want to briefly mention is global IR, which is actually not very similar to European IR. Most of what non-Western IR want, they want theory like realism and liberal institutionalism. They want theory to plug in and play with. And so that's another, those are a constituency of people wanting constructivism to be a singular theory about a certain group of things, norms, cultural identity, on state action. It's a part of this story that I think if we're really going to tell a proper constructivist account of, it has to be sensitive to the wheres, the whens, the whos, the hows, and in what context. So the Europe question is a really interesting one.
Anybody else want to get anything in?
Well, I just wanted to, as I'm like finishing up the book and writing the acknowledgements, it's always the emotional part. And this is actually a really great chance to acknowledge all of you in person. There's been, it's been a long journey, and I left academia multiple times almost and decided to stick around, and constructivism was actually a big part of that. Reading Wendt and reading the sort of commentary that came after that, and thinking that I belong there as a person of color, right? A woman of color, thinking that now I can do social theory too. It doesn't just have to be a certain type of scholar. That was really huge. And, Brent and Dan have played such a big role in ISAN Northeast related to that. And it's been a great community, and being part of Dave's ISQ symposium, and Dan asked, and these are just really exciting moments for me. And of course, Michelle and I know each other for a while and have grown up together. And so I don't know, I just wanted to thank you all for being part of this. And I just get very emotional thinking about what it would have been if I didn't have a community in US constructivism, and doing it for other folks, and thinking about sticking it out and not leaving. And there's a lot of theory to be written, and there's a lot of constructivism to be wrestled with. So just wanted to thank you all, and it's a really exciting time to be a constructivist. as we all are now, like I said.
Well, you can't see my face turning beet red, but that may have more to do with the whiskey than embarrassment. What I gotta say that it's really interesting to hear you say that, because I think if there is one experience that's common to being a constructivist, and I put quotation marks around that, in the United States, it's the degree that support and intellectual development and just people helping you stay in the game comes from multiple institutions and from networks built at conferences. I know that I was mentored heavily by people from Minnesota and other types of places, and I don't know if I would have been able to survive in this field without it. And I that must be a big part of a lot of people's stories, I would imagine.
Definitely the case for me.
I want to sort of thank Brent. He was one of the big people, and yourself, Dan, and Patrick Jackson, Cecilia Lynch, and many others sort of met and helped out along the way, just kept you in the game, kept you writing, kept your head down. And I'd be delighted to keep that process going.
And Dan, if I could just mention that's I echo what's all been said, and I thank Swati especially for her very kind words, because it works in other directions as well. Like we continue to kind of keep going because of the fresh perspectives, or even if they're critical, that we come into contact with emerging or emerged generations. And then I also want to say how important it is, because I caught this when you mentioned that to Michelle, that you've grown up together, right? That can be an important source too, is the people that go through the same shit that you go through at the same time throughout every single stage of this struggle. I mean, it's challenging because then they become folks that you talk to regarding, you know, who are good reviewers, who are good external reviewers, what are, you know, maybe, you know, you're thinking about in terms of which outlets to send your work to, what your experience is with particular individuals, if you maybe are going to put them on a panel or not. You know, I think Dave and I and Dan have, you know, had those discussions over the years, going back into the early to mid 2000s. And so, you know, having people that are kind of in the same sort of cohort can be very important as well. Recognizing that, you know, we kind of need everything there. And then we also shouldn't disown our own accomplishments. I mean, one of the reasons that a lot of people are still doing it is because they kept at it too. And that's challenging. And it's harder now than it's ever been before, with the lack of secure jobs in academia. And so sticking it out, as tough as that can be for those that do it, you know, you should be patting yourself on the back too.
I want to thank everybody so much for taking the time to do this. I really enjoyed hearing your perspectives, and I hope that our listeners do as well.
Thanks so much. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks. Bye, thanks, Dan. Bye. Cheers, everyone.
Well, you've done it. You've made it all the way to the end of another episode of Whiskey and IR Theory. And I'm going to assume that if you made it all the way to the end of this thing, that you either really like it or you were hate listening to it. And if you were hate listening to it, then that's just another way of liking it, right? So either way, you should go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from and give us a positive review. A 5-star rating would be nice because, you know, obviously we deserve it. If you do have complaints or questions or a subject you want us to discuss or a person you want us to bring on, I can't promise anything, but you should nonetheless email us at whiskeyindigoromeo@gmail.com. That's whiskey with an E because reasons. You can follow the show on Twitter at whiskeyirt, or you can follow me at DHNexon. I guess that's all, folks.